Welcome to Down Among the Donkeys, a podcast from the Donkey Sanctuary. In 13 episodes, we are telling the story behind the founding of one of the biggest equine charities in the world. Down Among the Donkeys by Dr. Elizabeth Svensson. Chapter 12. Donkeys Hit the Headlines. The summer of 1977 and the sailing season were in full swing. Niels, often accompanied by Clive, was racing regularly, and my weekends became busier and busier and tended to be rather lonely. Saturday nights always seemed the worst, and June, Sarah and I would try and make up expeditions, collecting fossils on the beach at Lyme Regis being one of our favourite trips, or going with our dogs for long walks along the cliffs. Rosie arrived from near Pontefract, and hers was a very sad story. The girl who brought her was a French student teacher, and she wrote us a pathetic letter saying that they wanted to get rid of the donkey and I wanted to buy it for several reasons. If it were mine, I would be able to have her hooves cut, which they have not done for more than 6 months, and it is a terrible sight. They are as long as a pair of shoes curling up in the air. Once its feet were walkable, I would be able to take it out from its stable, as it never goes out. It lives in a tiny hole. If you will take it from me, I will get it. I hate to think they might sell her tonight and push her half-crippled into the butcher's van for meat. She is standing day and night in a little corner, isolated from the outside by a window covered by a plastic sheet. Please help. We couldn't ignore this cry, and our fears were realized when Rosie arrived, as she looked even worse than we had imagined. Sadly, we were too late to help her. Her feet had not been treated for over 4 years in our estimation, and she had been totally deprived of any exercise for at least 6 months. We slowly started to feed her up and walk her gently each day, and she was given a large, airy stable, but the damage had already been done, and she died in November. We were more fortunate with little Tinkerbell. She arrived as a pathetic 8-month-old filly, her mother's condition as desperate as her own. She was very elderly and heavily in foal. Both were covered in lice and sores, but our attempts here were rewarded and both recovered fully. Our first taste of TV film crews came with the Animal Magic Unit. For 3 days the whole sanctuary was disrupted, almost all our time totally taken up by the demands of producer and cameraman. We would just get all the donkeys in exactly the right place that everybody liked, and myself just ready to start or continue an interview, when the sun would go in, or the sound of an aeroplane would intrude, and we all had to stop and wait until all the crew was satisfied. I never realized it would take so long to make a film that only showed for 4 minutes. Our next film crew was for the Angela Rippon Peninsula program, and this proved very much easier. I am not sure whether or not we had all got more used to the idea now and knew what would be wanted of us, but it certainly seemed to flow much more easily, and in 2 days they had canned enough film for a half-hour programme. Angela Rippon herself was absolutely marvellous. I had always thought I was full of energy, but I found myself rushing to keep up with her as she went round the sanctuary, finding the next ideal site for a new shot. She was totally involved with the work we were doing, and even when off film, would be asking me questions about the donkeys and their welfare. She really had a genuine love of all the animals, and I am sure this came across in the programme. There was one scene when we were in the main yard with all the geriatric donkeys, and as usual, Bimbo was standing with his head resting on my shoulder, totally ignoring the active film crew. Angela was asking me why I cared so much for these old donkeys, and as I tried to describe my feelings when I used to have to sit up all night with sick donkeys, and the way I tried to justify the existence of the human beings who had caused the donkeys to be in such desperate straits, my mind cast back to my night spent with poor Zebedee, who had eventually died. My eyes filled with tears, and I found it difficult to continue. The camera, however, kept on rolling, and I had to pull myself together. It had obviously affected Angela Rippon as well, and we had quite a job to finish that part of the interview. When it was over, I asked Angela Rippon if she would redo it, as I was embarrassed at my obvious emotions. The team agreed, and we managed to do the whole session without any breakdown. When the actual film came out, however, they had used the first part, so the second take had been in vain. By sheer coincidence, the two programmes came out on the same night. The Angela Rippon Report was a Peninsula programme and only shown in the Southwest. But the moment the programmes were over, telephones started to ring and I was inundated by offers of help, including some very substantial promises of donations, which all transpired. Later, we were approached by Magpie, the children's programme, and once again received a television crew, with Jenny Handley doing the interviewing. She, too, proved interested and sympathetic to our cause, and I think our donkey helpers enjoyed her presence more than any other. She had a superb figure. I don't think the Donkey Sanctuary staff have ever been so eager to help on a filming expedition as during the Magpie film. We particularly emphasised the educational aspect of the work that we were doing on this programme and tried to educate the children who'd be watching as much as possible, including in the programme the work our farrier and vet do daily. The most recent television crew to visit was the Go With Noakes team, as John Noakes was sailing round Britain and calling in at various interesting places. I think Shep was somewhat surprised to find so many donkeys, and we had to be rather careful where he was allowed to run, as donkeys are not particularly good with dogs. For the next few days after the filming, the sanctuary rang with cries of, "Get down, Shep!" The response to the Angela Rippon programme was fantastic. In view of the many letters received, the BBC decided to put the programme out again, this time nationally on BBC Two. And a conservative estimate of funds raised by this second showing was in the region of £40,000. A further bonus was that the publishers, Pan Books, had seen and been deeply affected by our story. The editor of the children's books wrote to see if it would be possible for Pan to take over the four books that I had by now written for the sanctuary, but I felt that after already making such a good income for the sanctuary from the sale of these books, we couldn't really let them go. To date, over £39,000 has been contributed from the children's books to sanctuary funds. Pan Books then offered me a contract to write children's books for them, which I am now doing. On the 3rd of May, Clive had his 17th birthday. We decided we would celebrate with a family outing to see the film ABBA, which everybody was dying to see. We had received a donkey the day before called Moppet. She had come from a good home in the Midlands, but her owners had lost the use of their field. This had proved disastrous, and she had been moved from place to place until her owner found her heavily in foal and in desperate need of a permanent home. I was concerned, on this particular night, about Moppet, as she seemed extremely uncomfortable, and just as all the family was piling into the car ready for the outing, I slipped into the isolation box where she was housed to check all was well. Immediately it was apparent that all was not well, and Moppet was in deep distress. Rather miserably, the family had to leave without me. I ran inside and rang the veterinary surgeon, who agreed to come straight out. Moppet was lying down with her foal half presented, but with the hind legs of the foal protruding instead of the forelegs. I knew it was going to be extremely tricky extricating the foal, but the mare was in such distress that I daren't leave her any longer. It took 20 minutes to deliver the baby, but at long last there was Moppet and the little foal called, what else, Abba. Moppet stood herself up and shook herself, and looked with some disgust at the wet little creature standing by her side. I moved the foal a little nearer to Moppet, and thank goodness she began to lick it. As soon as the mare starts licking the foal, it sets off a natural process which starts producing the mare's milk, and this action is always the first sign that all is going to be well. I was in quite a sorry state myself. The new dress I had put on for Clive's birthday was ruined, and I looked rather dismally at my filthy knees and arms. I just never stopped to think about what I was wearing. Moppet seemed fine, and I began to go past her to get to the door of the stall to go out and have a bath. To my horror, she suddenly lashed out with both back hooves and caught me a glancing blow on the thigh. I reeled backwards into the corner of the box and stood to see what she would do next. With her back end towards me, she stood firmly between the door and myself. I was in somewhat of a predicament, to put it mildly, as every time I tried to move, Moppet would make menacing movements with her back legs, and it appeared I was firmly trapped in the corner until the family came back from the pictures. Then there was a sound out in the yard. It was the vet arriving, and my shouts drew him to Moppet's box. Between us we were able to distract her so that I could wriggle out from her stable. Now that she's got used to us, she's the gentlest of donkeys and knows all our voices. Now, wherever possible, two of us always go into any new donkey's box. Our biggest problem between the two farms was finding sufficient room to winter all the donkeys. They are not as hardy as many people imagine, and to leave them out in the cold and wet through the winter months can be disastrous. We began to keep our eyes open for a suitable third farm which we could purchase. I was so lucky in the staff I had taken on. The office staff worked all the hours needed to get the work done, and Julie was helping more than I could ever have believed. Gradually, she was taking over the problems relating to the rehabilitated donkeys, and it was a tremendous help to be able to delegate phone calls to her on this side of the project. She soon learnt how to protect me from the many cranky calls that we received, and was wonderful in dealing gently with visitors who demanded in no uncertain terms that they must see Mrs. Svensson. The number of visitors was increasing each year, and we had to provide two guides to take them round, partly for the visitors' sake, but more importantly for the donkeys' sake, to make sure no visitors fed them anything which was harmful. Despite our enormous notices of please do not feed, people would try and give the donkeys the most unusual things, and, of course, items such as meat and certain plants are poisonous to donkeys, and even a carrot can prove disastrous with 30 donkeys in the same barn watching for it at the same time. Quite recently, we had taken a young donkey called Misty into the sanctuary. He had been bought by a kind and practical couple in Essex, and they had given him plenty of attention, the trouble being that the more loving care he got, the more he wanted. There were dogs and cats as company, but the dogs' company he disdained, and the cats he delighted in chasing to show his contempt for them. He had not been gelded, which may have been one of his difficulties, and which led to him giving his owners the odd nip as they passed. Basically, he was lonely, and he had become a problem. When in his stable at night, he misbehaved and, it seems, kept quite a few of the neighbours awake. To try and solve this problem, his owners would leave him out in the field by the house, if they had an evening engagement, and leave the television on and the windows open so Misty could tune in. He stood with his jaw firmly resting on the railings, his eyes glued to the box, and his ears pricked. The kindest thing seemed to take him into the sanctuary. Now he's made a good friend of another of our donkeys, Maxie, has been gelded, and has learnt not to try and nip us as we pass by. The writing of the newsletters continued apace, as these proved so valuable not only to our fundraising, but in keeping everybody informed of what we were doing. Lucky Lady and many of the older geriatric donkeys got very cold at night, despite their infrared lamps, and some kind people had knitted us some woolen blankets made from coloured squares which were joined together. The Angela Rippon programme had shown Lucky Lady with her blanket on, and I put a small appeal in our newsletter for anybody who had time to knit one. Within a six-month period, over 18,000 blankets arrived at the sanctuary, and we are in fact extremely embarrassed at receiving so many. We thought of all the possible things we could do with them, as there were many more than we could conceivably use, and in the end we made a special arrangement with the Save the Children Fund to send our spare blankets that weren't suitable for donkeys to them, and they in turn would help us on our journeys abroad by storing any items or drugs we needed for the donkeys, which would help us greatly. Of course, we had to tell people in the newsletter what we were doing, and the many people who wrote offering to knit blankets were sent a copy of the Knitters News, which put the position to them before they started the blanket. Outside, the dedicated workforce had risen in numbers under the watchful eye of John, and our veterinary surgeons were paying more and more visits each week. Every Monday was veterinary day, and they would arrive and go round our two farms looking at all the donkeys we were concerned about, and keeping a general eye on the running of the sanctuary from their professional viewpoint. They were extremely helpful and had helped set up the research programme into parasites. Approximately every second week, we would have to take our stallions into their hospital at Exeter to be operated on, and we found this a traumatic experience for the donkeys. It used to be a very long day, as we would have to leave at 7:30 in the morning to have the donkeys settled down and ready for treatment by 9:30 a.m. We would allow them to rest as long as possible afterwards before starting the journey back to the sanctuary, and often we didn't arrive back until 8 in the evening or after. Dear Herb made the greatest friends with all the donkeys. His duty after milking the cows in the morning was to go round every donkey, bathing its eyes, to prevent any problems from flies. The very elderly donkeys tended to get sores resulting from the irritation caused by flies on their eyelids unless we cared for them on a daily basis, and Herb was well known and loved by nearly every donkey. I think his greatest love was always Timothy, the donkey who had had his ears severed, and every day as Herb walked across the field, Timothy would trot up to him, and when Herb said, "Good morning, Timothy, what about a handshake?" Tim would politely raise his left hoof and paw madly in the air until Herb took it and shook it firmly. I have a sneaking feeling that the donkey's affection for Herb emanated from the endless supply of ginger biscuits that he carried around with him, but it certainly did the job, and he never had any problem catching a donkey to give it its treatment. In 1978, we had a very cold winter indeed. The donkeys seemed to sense something was coming, and there was a strange air of tension around the donkey sanctuary on Valentine's Day. One of our working staff was called Fred, and on that particular morning he opened the gate to take the tractor through, and to his horror, before he had time to close it again, a group of 28 donkeys from the nursery group had squeezed through and set off at a gallop up the drive. Fred wasn't too concerned, as the top gates are always kept tightly closed, but as he walked up to bring them back, not a donkey was in sight, and the top gates were wide open. Fred rushed back to get his bicycle and, without thinking to warn anybody else, set off in pursuit of the 28. He obviously hadn't realised how fast the donkeys were going to travel. Niels and I were quietly having breakfast when we received a phone call from the Hare and Hounds pub a mile up the road. "A group of your donkeys have just galloped past," they said. "There didn't seem to be anybody with them." Our breakfast forgotten, We rushed out to the door, jumped into the car and backed onto the little lane at the side of our house. Before Niels could put the car in forward gear, a herd of donkeys galloped back across the lane in front of us and turned neatly back into the donkey sanctuary gates. All 28 were there and beat Fred back to the sanctuary by a good 20 minutes. We all had a good laugh as we waited for Fred to come back, panting. The next morning, we realised why they had been so keen to get some exercise. We woke up to a thick layer of snow. Snow in Devon is unusual, and we all really quite enjoyed that first day. Even the donkeys seemed to like having a roll in it, and we took the opportunity to take some movie films, as we felt we might never see such a sight again. To our surprise, however, it snowed again the following day and the following day, and by Saturday the 18th of February we had a full-scale blizzard raging. Niels was at the hotel, and I was beginning to get a little apprehensive during the evening, as there seemed to be at least 2 feet of snow outside our back door. June, Clive and I put on our ski anoraks and tried to walk up the main drive of the sanctuary to see how deep the snow was. The drifts were already approaching 6 feet deep and we had to turn back. We tried to make our way along the little lane to the main road, but even these were blocked. To get back to the warmth of the house was wonderful. I rang Niels and said, "For heaven's sake, get home as quickly as you can, darling. I think we are going to be snowed in." Luckily, he had taken the Land Rover and he immediately set off home. It took him over 2 hours to get the 6 miles, and he had to abandon the Land Rover a quarter of a mile away on one of our lanes. He parked it behind a large Rolls-Royce, which had also got stuck, and left it thinking it would be easy to collect in the morning. By then, we just couldn't believe it. The snow had drifted and been blown overnight to immense drifts of over 14 feet deep. The lane where Niels had left his Land Rover was part of the fields on either side, and the only way you could tell where the lane was by a major road ahead sign sticking out of the snow by the main road. There wasn't a sound of a vehicle anywhere, and we found ourselves totally cut off from the rest of the world. John Fry, who lived next door, and I, with the children, began the hard job of feeding the donkeys and reaching all the boxes. Luckily, all were kept in and were warm, but they weren't too pleased at having to wait for their breakfast. To our great joy, Derek Battison, who was supposed to be on duty that Sunday morning, had made the tremendously dangerous journey of 2 miles from Salcombe Regis on foot, ploughing through drifts of between 6 and 14 feet almost the whole way. We were very pleased to see him, as obviously there was a great deal of work for us in caring for over 180 donkeys all trapped inside. Derek had to move in with us for 3 days, and as gradually one amenity after another failed, and we sat with no hot water, no lights, and rapidly getting short of food, he joined in the family games by candlelight, and we all made the most of a very bad job. On the fourth day, we put our skis on and skied down to Sidford to get bread not only for ourselves, but for the other people trapped around us, as it was physically impossible to move around without either skis or snowshoes. It was certainly an experience none of us will forget, and it was such a relief when the thaw came and we were able to move around again. The severe cold proved too much for Lucky Lady, and I was nearly heartbroken to find my old friend dead in her stable one morning. On the same day that she died, another donkey called Old Lady came in, so perhaps in a strange way, it was Lucky Lady's replacement. At the trustees' meeting held in February 1978, I pointed out the need to purchase new land as soon as possible, as the number of donkeys in the sanctuary had risen to 494. We were absolutely at maximum capacity everywhere, and none of us knew where to turn next. Packham House Farm, which was situated a mile and a half away, was coming up for auction that September, and a visit proved that it would be absolutely ideal for us. It certainly wasn't farmland, and previous farmers had got into trouble as much of the grassland was extremely rough and stretched away from the main farm at the bottom of the valley, almost to the top of the valley, over 116 acres. It was, however, ideal for us, and our desperate appeal for funds in the next newsletter to buy the farm enabled us to go to auction with sufficient money to purchase. Once again, we were in trouble. The local press produced enormous headlines: farmers protest over land for donkeys. And the Daily Mirror headed its article, "No Sanctuary, Slaughter Old Donkeys Call," and wrote, "A donkey sanctuary was lashed by angry farmers yesterday. They called for the old donkeys used by disabled children for riding lessons to be killed as pet food. It really did seem that few local people liked our sanctuary. I found it very difficult to see their point of view. The land we had bought was not good farming land, and when I thought how many millions of acres in this country had been turned over for agricultural use, I really couldn't see why the donkeys should be deprived of this infinitesimal amount on which to spend their last days peacefully. We waited until the hue and cry had died down, and then got on with the job of getting Packham ready for its new winter arrivals. There was a very large farmhouse, which we divided into two. Derek Batterson, who had been working with me now for over 3 years, was elevated to the position of manager, and he and his wife and children moved into one side, and Pat Feather, who was now working full-time for Slade, moved into the other side. Desperate efforts were made by all the staff, and the large barns already on Packham Farm had their full complement of donkeys by the end of October. Christmas 1978 found us rescuing our worst group of donkeys yet, just when I was beginning to think things were easing up. We were given news of 14 donkeys in Hampshire who were in the deepest trouble. A lady living near realised the state of the animals and made collections locally to raise sufficient funds to buy them and send them to the sanctuary. I must admit that although my staff and I are used to appalling sights, we were all too upset to speak as the donkeys came down the ramp of the lorry. They were all absolutely saturated with rain and had been in a field with no hay or hard feed for some weeks. Two of the mares were heavily in foal, and one had a tiny foal at foot, whom we named Noel, as it was so near Christmas. It was hard to tell he was white, as on arrival he was so wet that he appeared thin and grey. He was beyond hope. Little Noel died, but a tremendous fight began to save the lives of the other donkeys in the group, and we succeeded. With the assistance of the RSPCA, we hoped to bring a prosecution on the owner, but unfortunately, due to witness difficulties and the time element, this proved impossible. Just after they arrived, Bernard Braden and his team came to make a programme on the sanctuary, and they took some pictures of poor Jack, the stallion who had lost all the hair on his back due to the severe weather the donkeys had been exposed to. They were extremely interested not only in the sanctuary, but also in the Slade Centre, and the programme went out over the London region only. One day, we are hoping this will be expanded to the whole country. Every year in June, Salcombe Regis holds the most enormous fair. Led by the church, the whole village takes part, and exhibitions of local crafts and the most beautiful flower display in the church hold pride of place. We were asked if we could provide a donkey or two with panniers to collect funds for the event, and this we did, gladly. The donkeys thoroughly enjoyed the day and raised a tremendous amount of money wandering up and down the little village streets, whilst the milling crowds donated generously towards the fair. We were calling on the vets more and more, and the time was rapidly coming when it would be more economic to have our own veterinary surgeon. Andrew Trawford, a fully qualified vet who had previously been working with the Jamaican Society for the Protection of Animals and the Humane Society of Ontario in Canada, joined our executive team. A young, enthusiastic veterinary surgeon, he welcomed the chance to concentrate on one species of animals, and donkeys in particular had always attracted him in Jamaica. One winter night was quite an embarrassment. Niels and I had just gone to bed when I saw the outside lights had been left on. Clad only in Niels' pyjama jacket, I went down the stairs and turned the latch on the back door as the light switch was at the top of the back stairs leading down to the sanctuary. I had my foot carefully in the door so that it would not slam, but to my horror, Tigger, my outside cat, made a mad dash to get into the kitchen for the night. Unthinkingly, I withdrew my foot from the door and firmly put her at the top of the steps. You can imagine my horror when I turned round and found not only had I put Tigger out for the night, but also myself. The door had locked behind me. At this stage, I was not unduly alarmed, as even though it was freezing cold, I knew Niels was up in bed and would surely hear me banging the door and shouting. For over 15 minutes I yelled, thumped, shouted, and rang bells, but no Niels arrived, and by this time I was getting chilly in certain areas, to say the least. I did not know whether to be pleased or not when I heard footsteps coming up to the back door. Then Andrew appeared. He had seen the lights on in the yard and then heard my desperate yells and had come to help. I was trying to retain my dignity and talk to Andrew when the door from the flats opened and June arrived to see what all the noise and yelling was about. All three of us yelled and shouted together, but to no avail. In the end, I suddenly remembered that with June's key, I could get into my main office, and I went in and telephoned through to the house. Luckily, we have a phone by the bed. Niels was totally unperturbed, his first comment being, "Why on earth have you gone out just in my pyjama jacket? And where are you phoning from?" You can imagine my comments when he eventually came down and let me in. Andrew immediately took over the running of the laboratory with its essential work and the general health of all the donkeys, and I must admit I felt the most tremendous relief on his arrival. However, his arrival has brought into perspective the fact that we really need our own hospital block here. The journey to Exeter is really unacceptable in view of the distress it causes our donkeys, and a further major project will be to design and set this up. We are also going to set up our own scheme of inspectors so that we can more rapidly follow up the regular stream of complaints that come in from all parts of the country regarding mistreatment of donkeys. Having to rely on other societies, good though they may be, is no longer satisfactory. Donkeys have problems with which the average inspector would not normally come into contact, and we really feel that they need people with specialist training to be able to assess the situation correctly. They will be trained under Andrew, and Roy Harrington has just joined us from the RSPCA to be superintendent in charge of the inspectors who will look after the donkeys' welfare throughout the country. We shall continue our non-stop work to improve the lot of the donkey in this country and abroad, and to encourage our donkeys, once restored to good health themselves, to live and enjoy their lives to the full under our permanent protection. Two poor little donkeys arrived at this time, called Scylla and Alfred, and their arrival was disturbing in more than one way. Scylla's owner had always deeply loved and cared for donkeys, and was concerned when she began to realise Scylla was losing her eyesight. The vets were called in and seemed to think that she had a cataract starting on one eye. Despite regular treatment, she eventually went blind in that eye, and her owner rang us when she found Scylla was beginning to lose the sight of the other eye as well. She just couldn't bear to see her pet go blind. We collected Scylla and Alfred and brought them in, and even without professional training, it was apparent what was going wrong. Scylla's eyelashes were turning in and rubbing on the surface of the eye. This was causing irritation, which in turn was causing the cataracts, and our veterinary surgeons immediately operated to relieve the constant irritation. The sight of one eye was totally retrieved, and the other improved slightly once the constant irritation was removed. Niels and I had been invited to go to Berlin to the World Protection for Animals conference. We hadn't been to a conference of this sort before, where hundreds of delegates from all over the world and from other animal charities were to gather to discuss papers which had been produced by various experts in their own field. We were very fortunate in that we met Richard Ryder, then chairman of the RSPCA, and Bill Jordan, who was in charge of the wildlife section of the RSPCA. They were extremely interesting people to talk to, and we all got on very well indeed. The conference itself was of immense value, and we learned a great deal from the expertise of the many people we met. I gave a short talk on donkeys and found it very difficult knowing that my words were being translated into three different languages as I spoke, and so many knowledgeable people were there. The RSPCA were very interested in our purchase of Packham and the very beautiful woods and natural surroundings, and I invited Bill Jordan to come and look round at some time in case they would like to release any small wild animals into our sanctuary area. He arranged to come and visit us at a later date. My mother was failing fast, and on the day that Bill Jordan came to see us, she had a very sudden heart attack and died whilst having her cup of coffee in the kitchen. We all knew Mother had cancer and didn't have very long to live, and in one way it was very wonderful that she had gone so quickly and peacefully without suffering. Although I was heartbroken, as usual, the staff rallied round loyally, and I somehow managed to keep the sanctuary running. Now that the office had expanded and we had staff living in all the flats, I was aware of a constant danger from the point of view of a serious fire. The offices were situated over a stable block, and this couldn't be considered ideal from a risk point of view. I had the health and safety at work officers and the fire officer round to advise us, and we put in a complicated fire drill system, which has almost driven us mad ever since. We have smoke and heat detectors in all the stables, which sounds fine. They are supposed to set off all the fire bells when the density of smoke or the heat passes a certain level. To do its job properly, the system has to be very sensitive, and unfortunately, the warmth emanating from a large group of donkeys is sufficient to cause a reaction, and on regular occasions, anywhere between 2 and 5 a.m., all the fire bells go off, and members of staff, to whom we have said good night some hours before, suddenly appear in various stages of undress. One day, we hope to sort the system out, but so far it seems to be eluding everybody. After the Longleat disaster, we decided we must still hold a fiesta, as it had obviously been appreciated by those attending. But we decided that in 1979 we would hold it at Slade House Farm. This would alleviate the heavy cost in erecting marquees and also the trauma of the long journeys for the donkeys and staff. We chose the date of 19th of August, and this time the day dawned fine and bright. What a fantastic success it turned out to be. The cars streamed in from 9:30 in the morning until it closed at 6 at night. There were 6,000 people who came, and the net result was over £3,000 raised to help the Slade Centre. Apart from all the exhibitions on donkey welfare and their care, and a tour of the donkey sanctuary, the visitor could go into the Slade Centre where every possible type of sideshow was available, and round the back of the Slade Centre, the Slade donkeys were used as practical welfare demonstrations, with a grooming contest and later for fancy dress displays, and a gymkhana with every donkey being led instead of ridden. Everybody thoroughly enjoyed the day. We got outside caterers in to do the catering to prevent excess expenditure, and one of the most colourful sights was the beautiful mobile fairground organ, which kept the fiesta atmosphere going throughout the day. All members of the staff pulled their weight, and a thoroughly good time was had by all. John Rabjohns, one of our farm workers, affectionately known as Rabbi, made a particularly impressive sight, directing the traffic in a bowler hat. I wrote a poem by way of thanks to the staff. Fiesta 1979. A bunch of the boys were grouped round the rover. John, giving instructions, he was main drover. Julie was calm, her girls at the ready, and Pat's folks were busy keeping donkeys all steady. The helpers were there, the centre a dream, through which we all hoped many hundreds would stream. It was only 9:30, half an hour still to go, when Mother was heard shouting, "Here, wait a mo, you can't go in there, it's my bit of garden." The large crowd turned round, said, "Begging your pardon, we're here for fiesta, we know we're too soon. We wanted to come whilst there was still room." All hands on deck was the yell from above, and everyone ran, 'twas a labour of love. Off went the men who were manning the gate, those with rosettes and programmes of the fete. The organ arrived and fiesta was on. It was still very early, but ere very long, the traffic is queued out right to the main road. There's 5,000 policemen directing, I'm told. The rumours grew stronger, but those in the centre had no time to listen. It was work helter-skelter. Dot was surrounded, Tam was sold out. Jan found her stationery almost without. Mother found things most important to do. She answered the questions like, "Where is the loo?" Eeyore had eaten the sign with the arrow, pointing the way down the path oh so narrow. Rabbi was standing in best bowler hat, directing the traffic and sending it back into the field, whether it wanted or not, parked quickly by Terry or Dave in its spot. "Is that your celebrity, the man from MacDougall?" one visitor was heard to ask, very rudel. The queue by this time stretched right down Trow Hill. The policeman directing was feeling quite ill. The film tent was full. With people, yards thrived. The job in the vets was to keep worms alive. As folks in their thousands down microscopes gazed, they learnt of our work and were really amazed. The Yorks and the Gardeners, all on the go, DBS members running a show. Ken Burks and his family gave many a shock, and the Exmouth equestrians ran out of stock. Longleat was there to present the grand trophy. Pan Books gave a super large donkey called Moki. Charles Judge presented a wonderful cup for the disabled child who'd shown the most pluck. All our young staff had plenty to do. They collected the money, all counted by Boo. Over 5,000 attended fiesta. It could have been more. It could have been Lester. Rewards in money were really quite fine, but the best reward really was all of the time given so willingly in so many ways. Whoopee! Next fiesta, 364 days.